Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
The World Bank cuts its growth forecast for China. Plus, Beijing begins making major changes to its flagship infrastructure program.
The very fact that China now has a Belt and Road 2.0, it really exposes the limits of President Xi Jinping's ambition to reshape global order.
And about half of American schools report teacher and staff shortages. It's Tuesday, September 27th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The World Bank has cut its economic growth forecast for China to 2.8% for this year. That is down from a 4.3% forecast in June, as China contends with a real estate crunch and the government's zero-tolerance approach to COVID-19. Meanwhile, the bank is expecting growth among 22 developing economies in the region as they benefit from a revival of tourism and the dismantling of most pandemic restrictions. Journal Asia Economics reporter Jason Douglas says that's led to a rare role reversal.
For decades, China has been the engine of this region, just as it has been for the global economy in many instances. But what's happening now is all these other countries in East Asia taken together are forecast to grow faster than China this year. And the World Bank estimates that this is the first time that's happened since 1990. So this is a really unusual position.
We'll have more on a shakeup of China's Belt and Road infrastructure initiative later in the show. More than half of U.S. principals have reported that their schools are beginning the school year understaffed. That is according to an Education Department survey, which found that 60% of principals reported an inability to fill non-teaching positions and 48% unable to fill teaching positions. Hiring challenges were even more acute for special education roles. Many teachers have left the profession during the pandemic amid school closures and academic and behavioral problems among students. Pharmaceutical company Biogen has agreed to pay $900 million to settle allegations it paid kickbacks to doctors to induce them to prescribe its multiple sclerosis drug, the Justice Department said Monday. The settlement does not include an admission of liability by Biogen. A company spokesman said Biogen believes its intent and conduct was at all times lawful and appropriate and denied all the allegations raised in the case. Lumber prices have fallen to their lowest level in more than 2 years, a sign of a sharp slowdown in construction since the pandemic building boom. Lumber futures ended yesterday down 36% from a year ago and more than 70% from their peak in March when the Federal Reserve began raising interest rates to fight inflation. And NASA's uncrewed DART spacecraft successfully smashed into an asteroid late Monday in an effort to deflect the distant space rock and alter its orbit.
3, 2, 1. Oh my gosh.
The dramatic climax of the NASA mission was meant to test whether the technique could one day protect Earth from an asteroid collision. Central banks around the world are raising their key interest rates in the most widespread tightening of monetary policy on record. But some economists now fear they may go too far if those banks don't take into account their collective impact on global demand. Joining us now with more on those concerns from economists is Wall Street Journal reporter Paul Hannon. Paul, thanks for being with us. Hey.
Great to talk to you again, Luke.
You write that the situation we're in has few precedents. Tell us more. How so?
It's the scale or the widespread nature of these interest rates that are really unusual. So you had, in addition to the Federal Reserve last week, you had 8 central banks raising their key interest rates. By the end of October, it's quite likely that another 15 will be doing that. And by July already, we had by far the largest number of central banks raising rates at the same time. So this is pretty much everywhere, a few exceptions. And they're also moving in big steps. So you're seeing these sort of 1 percentage point, 3/4 percentage point moves after decades in which they were typically much more careful, much more gradual in their approach to either tackling inflation or stimulating the economy.
And so what has some economists concerned about all of this?
What worries them is that everybody is sort of like whacking the same mole at the same time. It's a global problem. It's a global imbalance between supply and demand. Some economies have contributed more to that than others, you could think of. But all these central banks are kind of looking at their own domestic situation and trying to contain inflation. And they're doing what they think they need to do that in their home environment. And the fear is that everybody is really hitting the same source of inflation at the same time without really thinking too much about what everybody else is doing. And therefore, there's a risk that things will be overdone. I've talked to many economists who are beginning to worry about this. Everybody realizes that inflation is a really big problem now and that central banks need to do something about it. They're just kind of calling for maybe a little bit of cooperation, a little bit of communication, a little bit of taking a step back and looking at the bigger global picture sometime soon.
Coordination, cooperation, is that possible in the current context?
Well, that's a pretty good question. I mean, it's not been a great decade for international cooperation on anything. Although if you go back to the global financial crisis, there was a good deal and they did work together to try and provide as much stimulus to the global economy as they could. But generally speaking, it is very difficult. And each of these central banks has a national mandate. The Fed is not paid to look after the global economy. It's paid to look after the US. So it's kind of hard to see that being formalized. But there may be more that people can do in terms of just talking to each other about their future plans and trying to incorporate each other's actions into their own sort of behavior.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Paul Hannon joining us from London. Paul, thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Luke.
Coming up, China's Belt and Road Infrastructure Initiative is getting a makeover. We'll look at why Beijing is shaking up the lending practices of its $1 trillion program after the break.
This message is brought to you by Nuveen. Nuveen has provided investment excellence for 125 years. A lot has changed, but one thing that remains constant, including the different types of durable income and portfolios, can help investors meet their goals. With expertise across income and alternatives, Nuveen continues to expand its capabilities while maintaining its legacy as a leading investment manager. Visit Nuveen.com to learn more. Investing involves risk. Loss of principal is possible.
China is starting to rein in its Belt and Road Infrastructure Program, the initiative that in nearly 10 years of existence has seen Beijing provide loans and fund development projects in almost 150 countries. And joining us now to discuss what seems to be the challenge for one of President Xi Jinping's flagship initiatives is Wall Street Journal Chief China Correspondent Lingling Wei. Hi, Lingling. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. So remind us, if you could, of the intentions of the Belt and Road Initiative.
Sure. The aims of the Belt and Road Initiative actually are twofold. It started out really as an economic program. The roots of Belt and Road Initiative dates back to the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. And back then, Chinese regulators really wanted the banks to invest the country's vast foreign exchange reserves to get better returns on those funds. And then when Xi Jinping came to power in late 2012, he basically put that initiative on steroids. Not only he wanted the initiative to keep creating markets for Chinese products, he also wanted to use the program to enhance and expand China's influence globally. So it's both economic program and a foreign policy initiative for Xi Jinping.
And so what seems to be the trouble with that program now?
In short, the program simply has expanded too fast during a course of nearly 10 years, China has spent nearly $1 trillion in loans and other funds in developing countries. A lot of the money was given to countries that had very limited ability to repay their debts. So that's really the biggest problem and led to a lot of criticism about China's lending practices. Basically, they further burdened a lot of developing countries with unnecessary debt.
You say there are some discussions underway in Beijing about a fundamental shift in this project going forward. What is the new plan under discussion?
So what's under discussion now is what officials call Belt and Road 2.0 in internal discussions. So this 2.0 version of Belt and Road means that banks and other Chinese institutions would more rigorously evaluate new projects for financing. They want the projects to be more economically and environmentally viable. And another big component of this recalibration effort involves how China really is going to do with all those loans that have already gone sour or at risks of going bad. We have seen China really starting to work more closely with other creditor countries in terms of restructuring debt. That's something they have resisted for a very long time.
Lingling, where should we be turning our attention to see if Belt and Road 2.0 actually leads China to change how it lends to countries and whether it's willing to renegotiate some of its existing loans?
We are already seeing Chinese banks sharply reducing lending to new projects in developing countries. And we're also seeing them basically very gingerly starting debt renegotiations in countries like Chad, Ethiopia, and Zambia. Those are considered test cases in Beijing. And if all those things go well, they might replicate their experiences in other countries. But uncertainty remains, certainly, especially over the willingness of Chinese banks to take losses. And one interesting tidbit we have heard from reporting this story is that they're telling regulators, okay, if you want us to accept losses, can you please let us classify those loans as policy instructed? Quote unquote. That means the bankers themselves wouldn't be held accountable for those defaults.
Is there an element of political sensitivity here that needing to admit that a 2.0 version of Belt and Road is needed is sort of a political liability for Chinese leadership?
So the very fact that China now has a Belt and Road 2.0 is a tacit admission that Belt and Road, the initial version, hasn't worked out quite well. It really exposes the limits of President Xi Jinping's ambition to reshape global order. And this troubled initiative adds to the problems he is facing domestically as well. So all those things are basically coming at not a great time for him because he is seeking to extend his rule for another term, a third five-year term, at an upcoming Communist Party conference in October. So we have already seen challenges to his authority, but whether or not those changes will lead to more fundamental course correction, we will have to wait and see.
Lingling Wei is the Wall Street Journal chief China correspondent. And as always, Lingling, we are grateful to have you with us on the program. Thank you so much for the time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Luke.
And finally, UK outlet Greggs is famed for its baked goods and sausage rolls, but it recently teamed up with clothing chain Primark to roll out its own apparel line, featuring fanny packs and tank tops all bearing the Greggs logo. That may sound unusual, but it is just the latest fashion odd couple that has seen the likes of cosmetics brand Elf selling eyeshadow for coffee and donut chain Dunkin', or supermarket Lidl offering Lidl-branded sneakers. Wall Street Journal reporter James Hookway explains what inspired Greggs to get in on the crossover marketing.
They don't take it too seriously. It's like an extreme version of normcore. You know, the idea of like dad fashion. You get something very mundane and then somehow that becomes a virtue in and of itself. I think it's certainly brought Greggs into a wider attention. They recently launched a Greggs superstore in Leicester Square, which is right in the centre of the West End of London. So the launch of the clothing kind of occurred at the same time, and it certainly helped to generate quite a bit more interest in what Greggs are up to and who they are.
All right, time for an admission. I ordered a broccoli cheddar bathing suit from Panera Bread last year, so I can relate. And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.